The Two Divorces. Chapter 8. The Royal Session. Affairs had changed in England during the absence of Tunstall and More, and even before their departure, events of a certain importance had occurred. Henry, finding there was nothing more to hope from Rome, had turned to Wassily and Campeggio. The Roman nuncio had succeeded in deceiving the king. "Campeggio is very different from what he is reported," said Henry to his friends. "He is not for the emperor as I was told. I have said somewhat to him which has changed his mind. No doubt he had made some brilliant promise." Henry, therefore, imagining himself sure of his two legates, desired them to proceed with the matter of the divorce without delay. There was no time to lose, for the king was informed that the pope was on the point of recalling the commission given to the two cardinals. And as early as the of March, Salviati, the pope's uncle and secretary of state, wrote to Campeggio about it. Henry's process, once in the court of the pontifical chancery, it would have been long before it got out again. Accordingly, on the 31st of May, the king, by a warrant under the great seal, gave the legates leave to execute their commission, without any regard to his own person, and having the fear of God only before their eyes. The legates themselves had suggested this formula to the king. On the same day the commission was opened, but to begin the process was not to end it. Every letter which the nuncio received forbade him to do so in the most positive manner. "Advance slowly and never finish," were Clement's instructions. The trial was to be a farce, played by a pope and two cardinals. The ecclesiastical court met in the great hall of the Blackfriars, commonly called the Parliament Chamber. The two legates, having successively taken the commission in their hands, devoutly declared that they were resolved to execute it, they should have said, to elude it, made the required oaths, and ordered a peremptory citation of the king and queen to appear on the 18th of June at 9 in the morning. Campeggio was eager to proceed slowly. The session was adjourned for 3 weeks. The citation caused a great stir among the people. "What?" said they. "A king and a queen constrained to appear, in their own realm, before their own subjects. The papacy set an example which was to be strictly followed in after years both in England and in France." On the 18th of June, Catherine appeared before the commission in the Parliament chamber, and stepping forward with dignity, said with a firm voice, "I protest against the legates as incompetent judges, and appeal to the Pope." This proceeding of the Queen's, her pride and firmness, troubled her enemies, and in their vexation they grew exasperated against her. "Instead of praying God to bring this matter to a good conclusion," they said, "she endeavors to turn away the people's affections from the king. Instead of showing Henry the love of a youthful wife, she keeps away from him night and day. There is even cause to fear," they added, "that she is in concert with certain individuals who have formed the horrible design of killing the king and the cardinal." But persons of generous heart, seeing only a queen, a wife, and a mother, attacked in her dearest affections, showed themselves full of sympathy for her. On the 21st of June, the day to which the court adjourned, the two legates entered the Parliament chamber with all the pomp belonging to their station, and took their seats on a raised platform. Near them sat the bishops of Bath and Lincoln, the abbot of Westminster, and Dr. Taylor, master of the rolls, whom they had added to their commission. Below them were the secretaries, among whom the skillful Stephen Gardiner held the chief rank. On the right hung a cloth of estate where the king sat surrounded by his officers, and on the left, a little lower, was the queen, attended by her ladies. The Archbishop of Canterbury and the bishops were seated between the legates and Henry VIII, and on both sides of the throne were stationed the counselors of the king and queen. The latter were Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, Standish of St. Asaph, West of Ely, and Dr. Ridley. The people, when they saw this procession defile before them, were far from being dazzled by the pomp. "Less show and more virtue," they said, "would better become such judges." The pontifical commission having been read, the legates declared that they would judge without fear or favor, and would admit of either recusation nor appeal. Then the usher cried, "Henry, King of England, come into court." The king, cited in his own capital to accept as judges two priests, his subjects, repressed the throbbing of his proud heart, and replied, in the hope that this strange trial would have a favorable issue, "Here I am." The usher continued, "Catherine, Queen of England, come into court." The queen handed the cardinals a paper in which she protested against the legality of the court, as the judges were the subjects of her opponent, and appealed to Rome. The cardinals declared they could not admit this paper, and consequently Catherine was again called into court. At this second summons she rose, devoutly crossed herself, made the circuit of the court to where the king sat, bending with dignity as she passed in front of the legates, and fell on her knees before her husband. Every eye was turned upon her. Then speaking in English, but with a Spanish accent, which by recalling the distance she was from her native home, pleaded eloquently for her, Catherine said with tears in her eyes, and in a tone at once dignified and impassioned, "Sire, I beseech you, for all the love that hath been between us, and for the love of God, let me have justice and right. Take some pity on me, for I am a poor woman and a stranger, born out of your dominions. I have here no assured friends, much less impartial counsel, and I flee to you as to the head of justice within this realm. Alas! Sir, wherein have I offended you, or what occasion given you of displeasure, that you should wish to put me from you? I take God and all the world to witness, that I have been to you a true, humble, and obedient wife, ever conformable to your will and pleasure. Never have I said or done aught contrary thereto, being always well pleased and content with all things wherein you had delight. Either did I ever grudge in word or countenance, or show a visage or spark of discontent. I loved all those whom you loved, only for your sake. This 20 years I have been your true wife, and by me ye have had divers children, although it hath pleased God to call them out of this world, which yet hath been no default in me." The judges, and even the most servile of the courtiers, were touched when they heard these simple and eloquent words, and the queen's sorrow moved them almost to tears. Catherine continued, "Sire, when you married me at the first, I take God to be my judge I was a true maid, and whether it be true or not, I put it to your conscience. If there be any just cause that ye can allege against me, I am contented to depart from your kingdom, albeit to my great shame and dishonor, and if there be none, then let me remain in my former estate until death. Who united us? The king, your father, who was called the second Solomon, and my father, Ferdinand, who was esteemed one of the wisest princes that, for many years before, had reigned in Spain. It is not, therefore, to be doubted that the marriage between you and me is good and lawful. Who are my judges? Is not one the man that has put sorrow between you and me? A judge whom I refuse and abhor. Who are the counselors assigned me? Are they not officers of the crown, who have made oath to you in your own counsel? Sir, I conjure you not to call me before a court so formed. Yet, if you refuse me this favor, your will be done, I shall be silent, I shall repress the emotions of my soul, and remit my just cause to the hands of God." Thus spoke Catherine through her tears. Humbly bending, she seemed to embrace Henry's knees. She rose and made a low obeisance to the king. It was expected that she would return to her seat, but leaning on the arm of Griffiths, her receiver general, she moved towards the door. The king, observing this, ordered her to be recalled, and the usher following her, thrice cried aloud, "Catherine, Queen of England, come into court." "Madam," said Griffiths, "you are called back." "I hear it well enough," replied the queen. "But go you on, for this is no court wherein I can have justice. Let us proceed." Catherine returned to the palace, and never again appeared before the court either by proxy or in person. She had gained her cause in the minds of many. The dignity of her person, the quaint simplicity of her speech, the propriety with which, relying 1972 upon her innocence, she had spoken of the most delicate subjects, and the tears which betrayed her emotion, had created a deep impression. But the sting in her speech, as an historian says, was her appeal to the king's conscience, and to the judgment of Almighty God, on the capital point in the cause. "How could a person so modest, so sober in her language," said many, "dare utter such a falsehood? Besides, the king did not contradict her." Henry was greatly embarrassed. Catherine's words had moved him. Catherine's defense, one of the most touching in history, had gained over the accuser himself. He therefore felt constrained to render this testimony to the accused. "Since the queen has withdrawn, I will, in her absence, declare to you all present that she has been to me as true and obedient a wife as I could desire. She has all the virtues and good qualities that belong to a woman. She is as noble in character as in birth." But Wolsey was the most embarrassed of all. When the queen had said, without naming him, that one of her judges was the cause of all her misfortunes, looks of indignation were turned upon him. He was unwilling to remain under the weight of this accusation. As soon as the king had finished speaking, he said, "Sir, I humbly beg your majesty to declare before this audience whether I was the first or chief mover in this business." Wolsey had formerly boasted to Du Bellay that the first project of the divorce was set on foot by himself, to create a perpetual separation between the houses of England and Spain, but now it suited him to affirm the contrary. The king, who needed his services, took care not to contradict him. "My lord cardinal," he said, "I can well excuse you herein. Mary, so far from being a mover, ye have been rather against me in attempting thereof. It was the Bishop of Tarbes, the French ambassador, who begot the first scruples in my conscience by his doubts on the legitimacy of the Princess Mary." This was not correct. The Bishop of Tarbes was not in England before the year 1527, and we have proofs that the king was meditating a divorce in 1526. "From that hour," he continued, "I was much troubled, and thought myself in danger of God's heavy displeasure, who, wishing to punish my incestuous marriage, had taken away all the sons my wife had borne me. I laid my grief before you, my Lord of Lincoln, then being my ghostly father, and by your advice I asked counsel of the rest of the bishops, and you all informed me under your seals that you shared in my scruples." "That is the truth," said the Archbishop of Canterbury. "No, sir, not so, under correction," quoth the Bishop of Rochester. "You have not my hand and seal." "No," exclaimed the king, showing him a paper which he held in his hand. "Is not this your hand and seal?" "No, forsooth," he answered. Henry's surprise increased, and turning with a frown to the Archbishop of Canterbury, he asked him, "What say you to that?"
"Sir, it is his hand and seal," replied Warham.
"It is not," rejoined Rochester.
"I told you I would never consent to any such act."
"You say the truth," responded the Archbishop, "but you were fully resolved at the last that I should subscribe your name and put your seal."
"All which is untrue," added Rochester, in a passion. The bishop was not very respectful to his primate.
"Well, well," said the king, wishing to end the dispute, "we will not stand in argument with you, for you are but one man." The court adjourned. The day had been better for Catherine than for the prelates. In proportion as the first sitting had been pathetic, so the discussions in the second between the lawyers and bishops were calculated to revolt a delicate mind. The advocates of the two parties vigorously debated pro and con respecting the consummation of Arthur's marriage with Catherine.
"It is a very difficult question," said one of the council.
"None can know the truth,
but I know it," replied the Bishop of Rochester.
"What do you mean?" asked Wolsey.
"My lord," he answered, "he was the very truth who said, 'What God hath joined together, let not man put asunder.' That is enough for me."
"So everybody thinks," rejoined Wolsey.
"But whether it was God who united Henry of England and Catherine of Aragon, hoc restat probandum, that remains to be proved.
The king's council decides that the marriage is unlawful, and consequently it was not God who joined them together."
The two bishops then exchanged a few words less edifying than those of the preceding day. Several of the hearers expressed a sentiment of disgust.
"It is a disgrace to the court," said Dr. Ridley with no little indignation,
"that you dare discuss questions which fill every right-minded man with horror."
This sharp reprimand put an end to the debate. The agitations of the court spread to the convents. Priests, monks, and nuns were everywhere in commotion. It was not long before astonishing revelations began to circulate through the cloisters. There was no talk then of an old portrait of the Virgin that winked its eyes, but other miracles were invented.
"An angel," it was rumored, "has appeared to Elizabeth Barton, the maid of Kent, as he did formerly to Adam, to the patriarchs, and to Jesus Christ."
At the epochs of the creation and of the redemption, and in the times which lead from one to the other, miracles are natural. God then appeared, and his coming without any signs of power would be as surprising as the rising of the sun unattended by its rays of light. But the Romish Church does not stop there. It claims in every age, for its saints, the privilege of miraculous powers, and the miracles are multiplied in proportion to the ignorance of the people. And accordingly the angel said to the epileptic maid of Kent,
"Go to the unfaithful King of England, and tell him there are three things he desires, which I forbid now and forever.
The first is the power of the Pope, the second the new doctrine, the third and bullion. If he takes her for his wife, God will visit him."
The vision-seeing maid delivered the message to the king, whom nothing could now stop. On the contrary, he began to find out that Wolsey proceeded too slowly, and the idea sometimes crossed his mind that he was betrayed by this minister. One fine summer's morning, Henry, as soon as he rose, summoned the cardinal to him at Bridewell. Wolsey hastened thither, and remained closeted with the king from 11 till 12. The latter gave way to all the fury of his passion and the violence of his despotism. "We must finish this matter promptly," he said. "We must positively." Wolsey retired very uneasy, and returned by the Thames to Westminster. The sun darted his bright rays on the water. The Bishop of Carlisle, who sat by the cardinal's side, remarked, as he wiped his forehead, "A very warm day, my lord." "Yes," replied the unhappy Wolsey. "If you had been chafed for an hour as I have been, you would say it was a hot day." When he reached his palace, the cardinal lay down on his bed to seek repose. He was not quiet long. Catherine had grown in Henry's eyes, as well as in those of the nation. The king shrank from a judgment. He even began to doubt of his success. He wished that the queen would consent to a separation. This idea occurred to his mind after Wolsey's departure, and the cardinal had hardly closed his eyes before the Earl of Wiltshire, and Bullen's father, was announced to him with a message from the king. "It is His Majesty's pleasure," said Wiltshire, "that you represent to the queen the shame that will accrue to her from a judicial condemnation, and persuade her to confide in his wisdom." Wolsey, commissioned to execute a task he knew to be impossible, exclaimed, "Why do you put such fancies in the king's head?" And then he spoke so reproachfully that Wiltshire, with tears in his eyes, fell on his knees beside the cardinal's bed. Bullen, desirous of seeing his daughter Queen of England, feared perhaps that he had taken a wrong course. "It is well," said the cardinal, recollecting that the message came from Henry VIII. "I am ready to do everything to please His Majesty." He rose, went to Bath Place to fetch Campeggio, and together they waited on the queen. The two legates found Catherine quietly at work with her maids of honor. Wolsey addressed the queen in Latin. "Nay, my lord," she said, "speak to me in English. I wish all the world could hear you." "We desire, madam, to communicate to you alone our counsel and opinion." "My lord," said the queen, "you are come to speak of things beyond my capacity." And then, with noble simplicity, showing a skein of red silk hanging about her neck, she continued, "These are my occupations, and all that I am capable of. I am a poor woman, without friends in this foreign country, and lacking wit to answer persons of wisdom as ye be. And yet, my lords, to please you, let us go to my withdrawing room." At these words the queen rose, and Wolsey gave her his hand. Catherine earnestly maintained her rights as a woman and a queen. "We who were in the outer chamber," says Cavendish, "from time to time could hear the queen speaking very loud, but could not understand what she said." Catherine, instead of justifying herself, boldly accused her judge. "I know, Sir Cardinal," she said with noble candor, "I know who has given the king the advice he is following. It is you. I have not ministered to your pride. I have blamed your conduct. I have complained of your tyranny. And my nephew the emperor has not made you pope. Hence all my misfortunes. To revenge yourself you have kindled a war in Europe, and have stirred up against me this most wicked matter. God will be my judge, and yours." Wolsey would have replied, but Catherine haughtily refused to hear him, and while treating Campeggio with great civility, declared that she would not acknowledge either of them as her judge. The cardinals withdrew, Wolsey full of vexation, and Campeggio beaming with joy, for the business was getting more complicated. Every hope of accommodation was lost. Nothing remained now but to proceed judicially.